Thank you so much to Jennifer and to the Mellon Foundation and to the Slavic Department for making my visit here possible. It's really gratifying to be back here. It makes me feel simultaneously very old and very young. And as I was walking up the steep hill to get here, I recall that I first started becoming interested in gender and Russian culture almost exactly 20 years ago when I took a class here with Professor Kavanaugh on women in Russian literature. So it's really exciting to be still thinking about gender and Russian culture all of those years later. So the talk that I'm going to be giving today, as you might have guessed, is based on material from my book, which Jennifer mentioned. And what I'd like to do is, for roughly the first half of the talk, introduce you kind of to the general structure of the work, to give you an overview of some of the questions that I pose, to introduce you to my conceptual framework. And then for roughly the second half of the talk, I'm going to narrow my focus and talk more specifically and concretely about one of the individual chapters. And of course, I'm happy to go into more depth about any of the chapters that I leave out of this talk in the question and answer period. So I'd like to begin by pointing out that according to traditional Russian folk belief, a bad mother or a sinful mother can be a sign that the end of the world is coming. And at the end of the 1990s, there were several elderly women from the Staroruski district in the Novgorod region of Western Russia who thought that the end of time was in fact drawing near. And they based this belief on the changes that they observed in their local icon of the Mother of God. And I have on the slide here a very well-known Mother of God icon from Vladimir, which obviously wasn't the one that these women were looking at, but they might have been looking at something quite similar, and I think it's useful to have a visual point of reference. So the women claimed, when looking at their local Mother of God icon, that they had witnessed a change in her expression, that she had turned away from Christ, and they interpreted this as irrefutable evidence of the impending apocalypse. The Mother of God had spurned Christ, these women believed, because so many women now, this is Russia in the late 1990s, so many women now were scorning their maternal obligations by having fewer children and hastening the depopulation of the Russian land. The disappearance of children had led to this somber and what they described as a joyless time in which even the birds don't sing anymore. So, interpreting what these women saw, they are essentially saying that both the signal and the cause of Russian civilization's doom could be traced back to the figure of the bad mother, the mother who turns away from her child. In their vision of a transformed Mother of God coldly rejecting her son, these women read the specific circumstances of post-Soviet society, a declining birth rate, and the often acknowledged demographic crisis. So some of you might recall that in 1992, Russia experienced negative population growth for the first time, and this was an event that was greeted with much attention. So they're reading those specific circumstances of post-Soviet society in an iconic image of idealized maternity. In other words, their predictions of a worldwide cataclysm predicted by a bad mother reveal the interplay between the historical specificity of motherhood and a deeply embedded ahistorical maternal mythology. This intersection of the temporal with the infinite in the women's judgment of the bad mothers in their provincial Russian milieu neatly fits Theodore H. Gaster's definition of myth as any presentation of the actual in terms of the ideal, any expression of the concept that all things can be viewed at once under two aspects. On the one hand, the temporal and the immediate, and on the other hand, the eternal and the transcendental. In the women's description, the transfigured Mother of God icon represents the violation of the ideal of maternity in a specific historical context by actual mothers, so those Soviet and post-Soviet women who have refused maternity for what we can only assume were a variety of very complicated social, economic, and cultural factors. The predictions of these elderly women from the Staroruski district reveal the power invested in both symbolic and actual maternity by traditional Russian society. They also exhibit the blurring of boundaries between fantasy and reality in conceptions of motherhood, and by extension, the multifaceted value with which a bad mother can be invested. My project takes as its launching point the intersection between the historically specific and the iconic images of motherhood that characterizes the predictions of these elderly women. Does the women's faith in the Mother of God's ability to predict the future indicate the depth of their reverence for iconic motherhood? Or does their vision of the icon's unmaternal behavior reveal a decrease in that reverence? Are the women projecting their despair at historically contingent bad motherhood onto the icon? Or is the ideal of motherhood altered by their particular experience of motherhood's reality? Although it's certainly not possible to penetrate the individual psychology of these women, and I'm certainly not attempting to do that, but I start with this incident because I think it provides a very clear crystallization of the questions that I'm striving to explore in my study. So what precisely does it mean to be a bad mother in the context of a culture where, according to the philosopher Nikolai Berdyaev, motherhood is the fundamental category? And the centrality of the mother in the Russian cultural imaginary dates from very far back, from the earliest days of the pre-Christian Slavs, who worshipped a divinity called Moist Mother Earth, or Matsira Zimlya. This prominence continues into the adoption of Orthodox Christianity, where the traits of that earlier pagan goddess merge with its new maternal divinity, Mary. And it's, I think, worth pointing out that in Mary, Mary in Russian is called the Bogorodica, right, from the verb, of course, to rodit, to give birth, which stresses her function as the one who actually gave birth to Christ, as opposed to the Western Church, which stresses her virginity. And this fundamental difference in conceptualizations of Mary provides a significant difference between Russian Orthodoxy and the Western Church. The centrality of motherhood, of the maternal image in Russian culture, continues into the 20th century. And I'm sure many, if not all of you, recognize this very well-known Soviet World War II poster, one of the most iconic patriotic images from the World War II period, with Russia embodied as a mother. And then another, probably maybe less well-known, but still probably quite prominent, World War II era image that features mothers prominently. And of course, one of the questions that I always ask my students when I teach women in Russian culture is, how many children do you think you need to have in order to qualify as a heroine mother? They always guess low. Of course, the right answer is 10, right, as you see here. So if we consider this long-standing centrality of the mother figure in the Russian cultural imaginary, the questions that I pose include the following. How do cultural, socioeconomic, and political factors influence definitions of positive and negative maternal behavior? How are these influences reflected in the cultural production of a given era? Can the bad mother be identified as a recurrent trope in Russian culture, one that encompasses several historical periods as well as multiple media and genres? What continuities as well as what disparities exist in the representation of this image by different authors with different implied readerships and in the highly disparate circumstances that characterize Russian, Soviet, and post-Soviet history? Does the figure of the bad mother violate the maternal ideal by exposing its contingency and its variability? Or does it merely reaffirm the tenacity of the myth of the beneficent, the self-sacrificing Russian mother? In exploring the answers to these questions, what I don't do is I don't attempt to provide a kind of encyclopedic survey of all of the possible examples of bad motherhood that we can find in Russian culture that would have produced a tome significantly longer than the one that I produced, and probably Northwestern nor any other press would have been willing to publish it. So instead of the sort of encyclopedic approach, what I do to attempt to elucidate this juncture between the temporal and the transcendental in representations of Russian maternity, I narrow the chronological focus of my project, and I concentrate on the image of the bad mother, which I define as one who shuns, subverts, or manipulates the maternal myth in three crucial periods of Russian and Soviet history. And my choice of three periods is inspired partially by the work of an American scholar, E.N. Kaplan, who published a work examining cultural representations of motherhood in England and in the U.S., in which she proposes in her work are three what she terms major economic, political, technological eruptions that affected the historical mother and produced corresponding changes in mother discourses. And for Western Europe, the three major eruptions that she identifies are the Industrial Revolution, World War I, and the Electronic Revolution following World War II. And I contend that for Russia, you need three different historical upheavals in order to understand changes in motherhood discourses in critical periods of historical shift. So for Russia, I contend that those periods are the emancipation of the serf, the decade following the emancipation of the serfs, in 1861, the period of the Great Reforms, then the Russian Revolution of 1917, and then finally the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991. So consequently, the first chapter of my book deals with works from the 1870s, so the decade after the emancipation, the decade that experienced the effects of the Great Reforms, as well as the rise of radical movements culminating in the assassination of the Tsar in 1881. The reforms of the 1860s and 1870s not only included the liberation of 20 million serfs, but it also triggered a wholesale reevaluation of all the traditional institutions of Russian life, including, of course, the patriarchal family. In addition, the end of serfdom profoundly altered gentry life, forcing a more intimate involvement in the daily tasks of child rearing for some women, while forcing others to seek employment outside the home to prop up devastated household finances. My second chapter examines works from the 1920s, the decade immediately following the revolution, and also the one that experienced the effects of the 1918 changes in marriage and family laws, designed to, first of all, eliminate the authority of the Orthodox Church over domestic affairs, but also designed to speed up what was termed the withering away, or the отмирание, of the traditional family. And then finally, chapter three focuses on material from the 1990s, which saw, of course, the breakup of the Soviet Union and all of the accompanying social, cultural, and economic upheaval. My overarching argument for all three of these periods claims that in cultural works from all three epochs, a temporal or a historically specific bad mother emerges to problematize the eternal image of the self-sacrificing, noble, and heroic maternal figure. And by focusing on these three historical periods, it also allows me to situate more effectively representations of motherhood in Russia within a broader European and cultural context. And one of the main concepts that I engage with was coined by a historian, Ann Taylor Allen, who wrote a study of motherhood in Western Europe from the late 19th into the 20th century, and she coins a term called the maternal dilemma. And she defines this maternal dilemma as a striving to reconcile motherhood with women's autonomous individuality. So in other words, does motherhood circumscribe a woman's contributions to both the private and the public sphere? Or is it possible to fulfill other functions alongside a maternal role? Early 20th century European feminist efforts to attain this elusive integration between motherhood and autonomy focused on the concept of maternalism, an ideology that maintained that women deserved rights as citizens because of their contributions as mothers, that the qualities necessary for motherhood made women valuable to society as a whole and so deserving of full rights, of participation. This notion that women's pursuit of civil rights should be based upon their maternal abilities was vehemently rejected by Western feminists later in the 20th century. And I'm paraphrasing Allen here. By 1970, the shift in feminist debates aggressively refused to acknowledge motherhood as a universal female vocation, moral mission, or duty of citizenship. And the well-known French feminist Simone de Beauvoir once famously declared that the one feminine function which is impossible to exercise in freedom is maternity. And this is a statement that exemplifies, I think, quite well the ambivalence about motherhood that was a characteristic of post-war European feminism. So, to get back to Russia, as even the most cursory acquaintance with Russian history and culture reveals, notions of autonomy, individuality, public-private sphere, civil rights, not even to mention feminism, possess quite different definitions and connotations in both the Imperial Russian and the Soviet context. So given this disparity, what are the specifics of the Russian maternal dilemma? And equally importantly, what might the case of Russia reveal about the kind of maternal imagery that emerges during periods of transition and flux? The cultural production of a given era, by disseminating images of both good and bad motherhood, plays a pivotal role in reflecting, shaping, and fomenting the conflict between the individual and society that the maternal dilemma implies. My project attempts to shed light on these questions by focusing on the interplay between the immediate and the eternal, between maternal mythology and historically contingent reality in periods of exceptional societal shift. And it's my contention that it's precisely during these kinds of periods of instability that conflicts between iconic maternity and the actual behavior of real-life mothers comes into the sharpest relief. And I think the episode that I opened with is a good illustration of that point. And one of the sort of the secondary goals of my project is to try to address the lack of attention that has been paid to Russia in cultural histories of European motherhood. And of course, those of us who study Russia know that conclusions drawn based on a Western European model frequently are not relevant to the socialist and post-socialist context. So that's one of the sort of secondary goals of my work, is to try to sort of address some of that gap in the scholarship. So that is a brief overview of the conceptual basis for my project. And I'd like to just say a few words on the kinds of sources I use. So in my first chapter from the 1870s, I'm looking almost exclusively at canonical literature. So two big novels from the 1870s, Saltykov-Shchedrin's The Golovlyov Family, Gospoda Golovlyova, namely the central maternal figure, Arina Petrovna Golovlyova, as well as Anna Karenina, Tolstoy's Anna Karenina. And then in my 1920s chapter, I look specifically at popular fiction that was published in Soviet women's magazines, so magazines designed primarily for a female readership, for the new Soviet woman to read about what she was supposed to be like in those early years. I also look at an agitational drama. So this was a mock trial called Trial of a Woman Who Abandoned Her Baby. It was one of those mock trials that would travel around to workers' clubs, to various sort of factories, and be performed in front of a live audience. And then the work with which you might be, most people in this room might be the most familiar with, is Fyodor Gladkov's novel Cement. And then for the second half of my talk, what I'd like to do is present a bit of the material from my third chapter. So this is the chapter that focuses on the post-Soviet period, roughly the last 10, 15 or so, the first rather 10 or 15 years after 1991. And this is the chapter whose development was really altered most profoundly by the research that I actually conducted in Russia. I kind of came in with some preconceptions, and when I actually spent some time doing research, I found most of those preconceptions to not be validated by the evidence. So what I was doing in way back in 2005, when this was initially my dissertation project, is I was reading, was trying to get a sense of how the discourse around motherhood might have shifted in the post-Soviet years. I was reading newspapers, kind of magazines very broadly, academic journals to a lesser extent. And what emerged to me, the pattern that emerged to me, were two seemingly contradictory trends. So on the one hand, you had this tendency to portray mothers as the saviors of Russian society, to invest them with exceptional abilities to provide some kind of safe haven from the tumult of post-Soviet Russia. And the second, seemingly opposing trend, was this very apocalyptic mindset that was lamenting the demise of the iconic mother, agonizing that contemporary mothers could no longer rise to the same heights that their predecessors had, And that just like in the Russian folk tradition, which I mentioned earlier, a bad mother was the first indication that the world as we know it was going to end. So the interesting detail here is that you had similar notions being expressed not only by elderly women in a rural village very far away from the major urban areas, but by journalists, by psychologists, by academics and other members of Russia's educated elite. And these two trends converge to mothers both as saviors and as potential destroyers of Russian society around one very unsettling event in recent Russian history. I'm sure many of you are familiar with this. This is the terrorist act that occurred in Moscow in 2002 when the group of Chechens seized the theater during the production of the musical Nordost, so became known as the Nordost Theater Hostage Crisis. And among the group of Chechen terrorists who took the theater hostage was a group of 18 women. And the Russian media was predictably very interested in these women, in their participation in this violent siege. And there was a tendency in the literature that I was reading, the press that I was reading, to take almost for granted that these women, they had to be mothers, and that it was their maternal sentiments that had to have motivated their decision to go into that theater. And at the same time, interestingly, you had observers saying that the only way that you could solve this crisis was through the intervention of mothers. So to give you an example of what I mean here. So this is, I'm going to quote here, a psychologist who's analyzing the phenomenon of female terrorism and offering the following advice. We have to remember that a woman is a mother, the defender of the hearth, one who nurtures with kindness, with words, with beautiful actions. Who knows, maybe if simple women, perhaps even multi-child mothers, had gone into the theater, maybe they could have persuaded the fighters and secured the release of the children from the theater. And another psychologist argued that female terrorists are somehow more desperate and thus more dangerous inherently than their male counterparts, and that the only possible way that you can neutralize this exceptional volatility, this psychologist is arguing, is through the intervention of other Chechen women and the maternal instinct that they embody. So here, I will quote him here. The only thing that can hold any value for the female terrorist are the lives of women and children from her tribe. I would convince as many Chechen women and children as possible residing in the capital to come to the theater, and to give those Chechen women the chance to negotiate with the female terrorists. So for both of these Russian medical professionals, it's mothers, present or future, who are both the instigators of and the potential antidote to female terrorism. The first psychologist, the one I have quoted here significantly, even suggests that multi-child mothers, so the heroin mothers, may be the most effective in stabilizing the violent impulses of their fellow women. So in other words, a woman becomes more morally persuasive according to how many children she has given birth to. And these Chechen women involved in the siege, some of whom were not in fact the mothers, but rather the widows or the sisters of fallen Chechen fighters, could not escape their maternity. So regardless of their particular family situations, it is their conscience as mothers that must be appealed to and activated. Violence and its connection to maternity emerged as a leitmotif not only in this post-Soviet media coverage of the Chechen women, but also in that devoted to the cruel behavior of real-life Russian mothers. In its focus on the increased violence and sexualization of Russian society, the press featured frequent stories of abused and neglected children, including those mistreated by mothers. So for example, writing in the May 18th, 1999 edition of Rabochi Tribuna, the Workers' Tribune of Moscow, the journalist Sergei Rykov described his shock at reading the last month's police chronicle and finding so many accounts of infanticide. Reading off a laundry list of the most chilling offenses, he hopes to scare readers into a heightened awareness of the children living around them. Rykov also rejects the often made connection between infanticide and economic hardship. Poverty, a sense of impending doom, and chronic hunger are more and more frequently given as the reasons for why killer mothers and killer fathers murder their own little babies. And I thought the choice of the Anglicism here was quite striking, right? Of course, Russian has a word to communicate that sentiment, but he chooses to anglicize it here. I cannot believe this. During the blockade of Leningrad, children were murdered but were given the last bits, even one's own blood. Surikov's argument implies that in post-Soviet society, the righteous bonds of maternity that spurred such selflessness during the siege of Leningrad have worn thin. A desire to indulge in vice has replaced self-sacrifice, and parents now kill, not for a crust of bread, but because of unrestrained drunkenness and a parasitic way of life. I'm quoting him again. He suggests that the institution of motherhood has become corroded, that the norms of the new society have weakened the previously heroic instincts of Russian parents. Several Russian commentators from the 90s attributed grave significance to this perceived disappearance of maternal attachment, describing it in apocalyptic terms. So this is that second strain that I identified in the research that I conducted. So for example, Nina Fokina, in the March 19, 1998 edition of Through the Labor, begins by asserting that the abandonment of a child by a mother contains no linguistic roots in the Russian language, since our ancestors could not have predicted that such a word, motherlessness, bezmatershchina, would become necessary. This word is so awkward and so difficult to pronounce because it refers to a wholly unnatural and grotesque phenomenon. Fatherlessness, or bezotsovshchina, now pales in comparison, she writes, and not because Russian fathers have en masse rediscovered their sense of paternal responsibility. Citing an increase of 43% in children's homes in Russia during the prior 2 years, so this is 96 to 98, she suggests that if motherly emotions begin to recede in significance within a woman's psyche, then Russian society may be on the brink of collapse. So while the maternal instinct was stronger than all other instincts, all passions and temptations, the world, one could say, held together. And now it's collapsing, question? Judging by the speed that Russia is acquiring more orphanages, it appears that way. She also speculates that Russian mothers are devolving away from the ideal maternal qualities of tenderness and warmth. Scholars divide women from the point of view of motherhood into the categories of hot, warm, and completely cold. There is research asserting that until the 1960s in Russia, the first type predominated, so hot, and that in subsequent generations, young mothers are more distant and cold towards their children, that they are less interested in them and in their well-being, end quote. So citing unspecified research, she never provides her sources, she contends that mothers are becoming increasingly indifferent toward their children. And if you take this assertion and combine it with what at this point is a very well-documented demographic crisis, this is predicting a quite dark future for the country. So you have fewer and fewer children being born alongside an increasingly miserly amount of maternal love that is available from what, according to her, was the previously nurturing and loving Russian mother. Another article that portrayed criminal motherhood as heralding the demise of the Russian nation appeared in the Economic Newspaper of Moscow on November 19, 1996. Citing the example of a mother who had recently murdered her 13-day-old baby because she claimed she was unable to feed him, Simon Galishko poses the following questions to his readers. Aren't you scared to live in a country where mothers save their children from poverty by killing them? The author argues that a nation capable of producing such mothers lacks a future, with its people doomed to gradual extinction. Hence, the murdering mother foreshadows the eventual disappearance of the Russian people. Both Galishka and Fokina assert a direct connection between the primacy of maternal emotion and the health of Russian society as a whole. This exaggerated belief in the power and significance of maternity corresponds with the psychologists and others who advocated deploying mothers to liberate the Nordost hostages. Like the elderly women from the rural Staroruski district with which I began today, who believed that the collapse of Russian society was imminent because their local Mother of God icon had turned away from Christ, so urban Russian journalists, scholars, and other professionals attributed grave actual and symbolic significance to the maternal behavior of contemporary Russian mothers. So to put it simply, mothers can save the world, but if a mother turns away from her children, then all is lost. For the last part of my talk, I'm going to switch gears. Once again, I'm going to provide a representative sample of the more sort of traditional close reading of literature, which I also do in all three chapters. And I'd like to focus just briefly, I know we don't have too much time, but just a bit on one work by the contemporary writer Lyudmila Petrushevskaya. And I think it's not an overstatement to say that Petrushevskaya has spent really the entirety of her career really debunking this notion that Russian mothers can save the world. I think it's appropriate actually to end with her because it was this work that I'm going to talk about now that really sparked my interest in this topic of the bad mother and its significance for Russian culture. So there are lots of Petrushevskaya's works that lend themselves quite well to an analysis of this topic, but I'm going to just briefly focus specifically on one of her most well-known and critically acclaimed works, which is the novella The Time Night, Vremya Noch, from 1992. The novella, some of you may be familiar with it, it's narrated in a confessional first-person narrative from the point of view of the central maternal character of the work, a woman named Anna Andreyanovna. And just briefly, to refresh anyone's memory or for those who may not have read it, so Anna Andreyanovna is the mother of Alyona. Alyona is an emotionally fragile divorced mother of three young children. By the end of the text, she has three, all by various fathers. And the oldest of whom, a little boy named Tima, 5 or 6 years old, she's left in her mother's care, in Anna's care. She's also the mother of Andrei, a suicidal ex-convict who periodically shows up in the work to rob her. So during the course of this text, the reader learns about Alyona's first sexual encounter, which leads to pregnancy and an unhappy marriage, followed by an exploitative affair with a married colleague. We learn about Anna's delusions of literary grandeur and her desperate and cloying love for her little grandson, Tima. And most prominently, we learn in excruciating detail about the toxic and combative nature of mother-child relations in Anna's cramped, fatherless household. So it's a post-Soviet work, but it takes place during the Soviet period. The line between self-interest, self-dramatization, and self-sacrifice becomes blurred in Anna's exaggerated, acute consciousness of her own righteousness. She carefully crafts a chronicle of heroic motherhood, one that must compete with that of her wayward daughters and emerge victorious in their war of words, a war waged not only during their heated arguments, but also on the page, as Anna interjects her own caustic commentary onto her daughter's diary. The self-identified nobility of her actions provides Anna with the proof of her maternal superiority, in return for which she futilely demands total obeisance from her offspring. By the time Anna, abandoned by her children and her grandchildren, incoherently ends her solitary narrative, the myth of the beneficent Russian mother has been thoroughly and unequivocally debased. To preserve her illusions of maternal heroism, Anna employs her literary skills to rewrite the relationship with her daughter according to imaginary ideals. So for example, she has one brief phone call with her daughter that quickly disintegrates into hysterics and into mutual name-calling. And as soon as Anna very self-righteously hangs up the phone, we as readers are introduced to her rewriting of this conversation. So she ascribes to her daughter Alyona the role of the loving, humble daughter. Mummy, help me hoist just one more burden on your back. And to herself, that of the infinitely patient and comforting mother. No, my darling, you must be strong. Look at me, I force myself to be strong. I just keep going because I'm your mother. By privileging her own version of Alyona's speech over her actual words, Anna subverts her daughter's power to craft and retell her own story. In this imaginary conversation, which I just excerpted briefly, the maternal figure blots out all other human models and human relationships in her daughter's life. Anna presents herself as the ultimate and the sole example of sacrifice, constancy, and patience for her daughter to emulate. This narrative of traditional maternal self-sacrifice exists in direct competition with the one her daughter attempts to craft in her diary, which Anna contradicts, debunks, and ironizes. So Anna discovers her daughter's diary inadvertently hidden on top of a bookcase while she's dusting, and she feels perfectly fine, not only about reading the diary, but also about passing judgment on its contents. So the first diary, just to give you a flavor for this, the first diary entry details Aluna's sexual encounter with the married man who fathered her second child, as well as memories of her first husband. Anna inserts her own parenthetical, very sarcastic comments throughout the text, thus forcing the reader to discover Aluna's most intimate thoughts only through her mother's mediation. So for example, when a despairing Aluna writes of her desire to throw herself under a train, a la Anna Karenina, Anna Riley comments, "A lovely man she found to do it for." When Aluna calls herself a fool, Anna exclaims, "Precisely." And just to avoid any possible ambiguity as to who might be commenting on this diary, she inserts, and it's quite striking if you see it on the page, she inserts her initials, AA, after each one of the sarcastic comments. So throughout the diary, Anna also disputes her daughter's retelling of events and provides her own alternative versions. She repeatedly paints herself in a more sympathetic light, while at the same time casting doubt on Aluna's reliability as a narrator. Later in the diary, Anna even proposes a counter-narrative to the one Aluna unfolds. As Aluna discusses the details of her affairs, her mother interjects into the text a description of her grandson Tima's illness on the night Aluna stays with her married lover. "All this is nonsense," Anna declares, before enumerating the hardships she faced handling a sick child alone. She thus challenges not only her daughter's ability to recount events truthfully, but also her knowledge of what narratives should be developed. The tawdry details of Aluna's amorous affairs should remain untold, while Anna's tales of heroic grandmotherly self-sacrifice deserve textual inscription. The diary exists, according to Anna, primarily to keep score between her and her daughter. Future readers, including her grandchildren, should refer to it as a record of her daughter's improprieties, which in turn underscore her own heroism. Let them find out later who's who. Let them learn sometime who their mother is and who I am. Anna also attempts to define herself in opposition to her daughter by claiming superiority in her behavior with men. In her commentary to Aluna's diary, she professes to never having succumbed to weakness or to sexual obsession, offering the example of her own life as an instructive one. "I'm writing all of this for her sake too, so that she should understand who's led what sort of life. I, for instance, never suffered any pain from a man, never." And the reader, for the reader, this rings very false. Biographical facts that we have learned throughout the text discredit this. So we learn that Anna, just like her daughter, had an affair with a married man at her work. She also had a mother who hated her husband, just like Anna hates Aluna's husband. She was also left by her husband to raise her children alone. Nonetheless, Anna remains blind to the similarities with her daughter between her own reckless behavior with men and Aluna's. Because of the verbal divide that separates them, the parallels between the plots in the lives of mother and daughter remain unacknowledged. Not surprisingly then, Anna repeatedly points out the impossibility of true communication between mothers and children. "Ah, mothers, mothers, it's the holiest of words, but time goes by, and you'll find you've nothing to say to your child, and your child has nothing to say to you. Love them, and they'll tear you to pieces. Don't love them, and they'll leave you just the same. That's how it is." After children grow out of the prelapsarian state where parents and grandparents can derive sensual pleasure from their physical closeness, a verbal barrier that cannot be transcended arises between the generations. A few pages later, Anna laments that no new words or ideas can be exchanged between her and her two children, that they are trapped in a cycle of stagnation. Anna's feverish poetic endeavors, which her children repeatedly label manic or graphomania, fill this impenetrable silence. By ironizing her daughter's diary entries, Anna solves the problem of this verbal divide by eliminating the interlocutor and transforming feudal dialogue into self-aggrandizing monologue. Eventually, Alyona disrupts this fantasy by leaving with her children, including Tima, at the end of the work. Anna's final descent into madness accompanies the disappearance of Alyona and Tima. During the novella's final stream of consciousness pages, Anna fixates on the mother's solitary burden. I'm all they've got, have to rescue the lot of them, saved my son's life, yes. She returns to a silent apartment, and Anna's narrative trails off with a mantra-like repetition of the names of her children and grandchildren. The Time Knight's closing image exposes the isolation and the mental disintegration of a mother whose children and grandchildren abandoned her, thus depriving her of the role of the long-suffering and self-abnegating Russian mother heroine. Anna Andreyevna then remains acutely aware of maternal mythology, particularly the image of the mother sacrificing all on behalf of her children. Anna, and this is in the chapter that this is taken from, I spend quite some time comparing Anna with her predecessor, Arina Petrovna Golovlyova, who I argue also has this very exaggerated awareness of the effect that motherhood produces. Anna Andreyevna, as well as Arina Petrovna, redirect maternal self-sacrifice toward a selfish rather than an altruistic goal. Anna and her literary predecessor, Arina Petrovna, behaves with a heightened awareness of the effect that sacred motherhood produces, of the nobility with which mythologized motherhood endows her. This awareness renders problematic the distinguishing of pretense from authenticity in her maternal actions. So Petrushevskaya's mothers, then, to sum up, and Anna Andreyevna most prominently among them, fail to harmonize the potentially chaotic forces such as vanity, greed, selfishness, megalomania that threaten familial stability, rejecting the mediating function that characterizes the iconic Russian mother. This failure, in turn, challenges the notion that motherhood can somehow ameliorate the consequences of the rapid social change that occurred in Russia in the 1990s. Her works support the dire predictions of the Russian observers who lamented the extinction of the mythologized, self-sacrificial Russian mother. Petrushevskaya's texts question the notion of a maternity as a redemptive force capable of counteracting the social, political, or economic instability of the post-Soviet period. Instead, these mothers, these women with a thirst for destruction, and the title of my book is in fact taken from The Time Knight, these mothers bequeath to the next generation a questionable psychological, moral, and spiritual legacy. Thank you.
Great, so we have some time for questions for Jennifer.
Yes, please.
Yeah. No, actually, I have a couple of questions, so I'm glad that we have more time to talk to you about it. Maybe it's not necessarily questions. One of the things is, in my own research and working, particularly in contemporary theater drama, but also just kind of like in general in cultural life, one of the things that is frustrating and that I see here too is the kind of like that constant essentializing of female and women and womanhood. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in what you're saying here, your arguments for both the ones that, especially with the Northwest, both the ones that are saying like, we'll send the mothers in, and you know, they're both talking about this essential womanhood and essential children and so on. And I think my question is, because it's you know, I always find affirmation of that. Did you find anything to the contrary, other than Petrushevskaya, who is kind of like ironically trying to kind of like disrupt that? But just in a sort of like more general sense, and particularly also in an scholarly sense, I would say, because I find
Well, in the cultural realm, one of the other works that I examine in this chapter, I think, does, in a similar vein to Petrushevskaya, kind of problematize some of this essentialism, which I wholeheartedly agree with you. It's one of the frustrating things about working on gender in Russian culture is that you really find either one extreme or the other, but both sort of pointing to the same,
yes,
to the same idea. The other cultural work that I examine in this chapter is the film Adam's Rib, which is actually, some of you might have seen the film. It's about three generations of women all living together in a cramped Moscow apartment. It predates Petrushevskaya's text by 2 years, but it was actually derived from an earlier novella by the contemporary writer Anatoly Kurchatkin, which was published in 1986. And in the source text, you have, well, those of you may or may not have seen the film, one of the central characters of the film is this grandmother who's a sort of silent, tyrannical force. She's paralyzed and she's bedridden for the majority of the film, but it becomes very clear that she's sort of wielding this silent power over the lives of her daughter and her grandchildren, and that before she was bedridden, she sort of tyrannized everyone. But in the source, and so in my chapter, I analyze the transformation of this grandmother from the source text, where she was this kind of angelic figure, right? This sort of exactly, you know, the iconic Russian mother who, you know, embodied all of the sort of positive traits that allowed the family to function. And at the end of the film, she arises sort of, it's this kind of almost miraculous resurrection where she gets up. And the ending is very, very ambiguous because the other members of the household had been few scenes prior to that been sort of tacitly planning for her death and, you know, thinking what they were going to do with the space that was going to free up, even though that's not explicitly stated, but that's very clearly the underlying significance of their exchange. And the ending is very significant, is very ambiguous, right, where they sort of greet her resurrection with horror, whereas in the source text, right, it's this very kind of you know, positive, so the grandmother sort of arises in a similar miraculous way, but it becomes very clear that she's going to basically assume the role of the, you know, the heroic, the beneficent, you know, all-encompassing, you know, Russian mother. So I think the fact that, you know, within, that the screenwriter and the director chose to transform this figure in such a kind of, to turn her into something much more ambiguous and malevolent, I think is significant. And certainly challenges this kind of essentialism that you're pointing to. As far as the academic work, I mean, there is some fantastic gender scholarship coming out of Russia. Natalia Pushkareva, namely, is one who comes to mind. But they're definitely, I would say, a minority voice. And I just taught this class in Women in Russian Culture back at Davis, and it happened, our class session happened to correspond with Vesmova Marta, so I showed my students Putin's speech, right, where he congratulated all of the women of Russia with the 8th of March, with International Women's Day. And for my students, it was really, I mean, they were kind of snickering and laughing because it was really like a speech out of a distant time. You know, it was about how, you know, women are elegant and they're strong and they can shoulder these Herculean burdens. I mean, it was really such an affirmation of these, you know, tendencies that you identified. And, you know, for them, I think it was funny because they're living in a arguably post-feminist world, right? You know, world that experienced the eruptions of the 1960s and the challenging of some of these kind of essential gendered ideas about how men are supposed to behave and how women are supposed to behave. And that's really not to say that, you know, that no one in America subscribes to those essential ideas anymore, but they are sort of, it's uncomfortable to hear them voiced so directly and without any kind of irony, right? So I think, I guess that's maybe the essential explanation, yeah. Right? That this is not a, you know, post-Soviet Russia is not a post-feminist world in any sense of the word.
Which is kind of, you know, what you're saying with the 8th of March, it's that is kind of like the difficulty too. And I'm teaching a contemporary new Russian drama class right now, and almost invariably, with exceptions, the students, particularly the students who are not familiar with Russia whatsoever, think the plays are 20 years older than they are.
Interesting. Hmm.
Because, in particular also because of gender notions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we'll see if things change. In another 50 years, someone else has to write a book on bad mothers and see if anything has changed.
I think it's sounds ironic that so in between the two stories that they describe of the post-Soviet period or the Soviet period, I guess, is that it seems that kind of what creates the dysfunctionality and the destructiveness of the two grandmothers, I guess, is that for them, I guess, there is no other role to play
right. Of
this essential mother. And this is exactly what they just have no other option, or they perceive no
right.
other option.
Right.
Which is what makes the relationship with their children destructive.
Right.
So it's, I don't know.
Right.
Interesting.
Yeah, there's a really interesting dissertation, she's maybe published it as a book at this point, from Berkeley, the sociology department, about single motherhood, the phenomenon of single motherhood in Russia, where she did all this oral history. It's very interesting. But I remember the reason I mentioned that is I remember that one of her conclusions is that there's this real tension between grandmothers and their daughters, because the assumption is that grandmothers will assume the sort of Herculean, heroic, grandmotherly role. And not all grandmothers, apparently, right? Maybe to many of our surprise, not all Russian, contemporary Russian grandmothers kind of want to, you know, spend their entire day caring for, you know, their daughter's children. So it's sort of, she at least identified that as one sort of source of intergenerational tension in post-Soviet Russia. So.
Although, perhaps to be fair to Petrushka Anna in that, I mean, that's not all she does. I mean, she is the one who's putting the food on the table.
Yes.
She is the writer. I mean, we can argue about whether she has the delusions of grandeur,
right.
magical powers, and so on and so forth. But we have this double take. Actually, the book that we're reading is her book, and we think
right.
it's a pretty good book.
Right.
And then also, as you say, some of this, you know, this biographical information which sort of sheds a different light on her story and
right.
shows comparisons with her and her daughter, it's also been put in there by her.
Right.
So,
right.
So we have to take this into account as well. And I wonder what you thought about the fact that if there is some redemptive moment in the text, it's the fact that Leon has decided to preserve this text and
yes.
send it to the publisher. So what do you make of that? Because there's so many ways of reading that. It's one of the big enigmas.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, for the sake of time, you know, that was a more kind of one-dimensional reading of the novel than I give in the longer work. But yes, I think one of the endlessly fascinating things about Petrushevskaya's maternal characters is the fact that they are so complex. There's really not a single one who is unidimensionally villainous, right? There are always these very tender, poignant moments, right? There's a section of Время ночи where she describes, you know, all of the Herculean effort that she undergoes to try to find some toys for Tima, right in there, and it's very poignant and very touching. And I think, yes, that the most optimistic and perhaps even the only optimistic moment in the text is the epigraph, right, which to me implies that the daughter found the text and then decided to let it live on for posterity, right, that she gives it to an editor, right. So the presumption is that it will ultimately be Anna Andreyanovna's version of their family truth that is preserved for posterity. So she does kind of win, I guess, in a sense. And the fact that her daughter lets her win is, I think, you know, is a reconciliatory moment. Posthumous.
Yeah, right. The fact that the daughter's been recognized as someone with literary talent is one of the few nice things
right.
Anna says about her, that she's had the ability, the nous, to realize that this text actually is polyphonic. Now, whether we say it self-deconstructs or whether it's somehow Anna had even put that in there,
right.
but it's a far more complex story about all of them that results, and it is, in a sense, you know, an act of mercy or love for Aliona to her mother at that point.
Yes.
And maybe recognizing, well, she wasn't all bad, because one of the intriguing things is I think that a lot of the Russian readers actually didn't see that much bad in Anna.
Right.
Very much the Western could just say, oh yeah, she's such a demon monster mother there. Whereas
right.
the Russian, well, you know, she does all these good things.
Yes.
You know, what's the problem here?
No, I agree. And what's interesting, an interesting counterpoint to that is this film Adam's Rib that I was just mentioning. So I've seen it I don't know how many times, and I've shown it to how many groups of, you know, students and colleagues, and I used to give a talk where I excerpted some moments from the film. And Western viewers almost unequivocally kind of read it the way that I read it, which is this more ambiguous, that it is not a happy ending, right? That she resurrects from her bed and they've just been, they've just been preparing to, you know, have the space available. But if you look at the Russian press about that film, they all read it like they were reading the source text. They all read the resurrection of the grandmother as something miraculous and happy, and as basically a reaffirmation of you know, the strength of the Russian mother, right? That she can now, you know, get out of her bed and save the family. Whereas there's really, you know, to my mind, right, I've seen the movie so many times, I've never been able to identify any moments that support that kind of a hopeful message, right? So it's, yes, so that's, I guess, a topic for a whole other talk, right, is the lack of correspondence between Russian and Western readers and viewers around some of these kinds of topics, yeah. But I absolutely agree with you that she is a much more multifaceted character than, you know, than in the kind of that excerpt of the reading I probably made her sound. But in the longer work, I do try to analyze in more depth, you know, those moments where she is really tender and very empathetic as a mother. Yeah.
Yeah, and just jumping off of that, when if Alyona is the one who preserves the text and submits it to a publisher, I mean, that then plays into another common paradigm of essentializing women in Russian culture as these guardians of culture.
Mm-hmm.
With Akhmatova or Nadezhda Mandelstam preserving Mandelstam's manuscripts, or Bulgakov's wife preserving his manuscripts, except maybe here it's a guardian of culture but without the male counterpart.
Right, right. It's the daughter as opposed to the spouse as the as the one who preserves for posterity. Yeah, that's an interesting parallel.
So
yeah.
Olga Sadokova, and there's this really interesting introduction written by Slava Yastrzemski, where he writes her into this tradition, calling her a present-day guardian of culture in this tradition, of course, all female.
Mm-hmm.
All female figures.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's a really interesting element to have taken into account when reading that text, yeah. I hadn't thought about that. Yeah, students never catch that. It's always one of the questions I ask is, you know, are there any hopeful moments in this text? And they always say no. They say, well, go back and read the epigraph. So
thanks for the talk. It's very interesting. I was wondering what you think of the fact of the high, maybe highest in the world, number of kids in orphanages in Russia in light of this concept of bad motherhood and culture. I mean, in terms of, like, I just have found it to be intriguing. Why is there such a high level of kids in orphanages in Russia, Ukraine, other Soviet states, but I think Russia may be the highest in the world. And, you know, does that mean anything? Is that an objective indicator?
Well, I guess I don't want to wade too far into those waters because it's quite a bit outside of my area of expertise, but I can say that there is not culturally a tradition of adoption within Russian context, and I know this from, I had a good friend who went through this very protracted process of adopting a Russian child, and she told me, so this is, I guess I should preface this by saying this is anecdotal as opposed to, you know, the result of really in-depth research, but based on her experiences, that there is not really a culture of adoption, and if Russian families do adopt, they tend to adopt girls, right? So it is easier, for example, now of course those channels have closed, but it was easier to adopt a boy because, of course, the assumption is that if you, I guess, right, that we can understand that as the assumption that if you adopt a girl and you get older, then the girl is more likely to kind of take care of you and serve that kind of a function within a household than a boy.
But so they're giving up children. So, there's the adoption, but the reason they're in orphanages is because presumably the women, more so than the fathers,
right,
single parenthood, have given up those children.
I mean, I guess, you know, again, I don't want to sound like an expert on this topic when I'm not, but I mean, I guess my assumption would be that can be explained by, you know, economic instability, the difficulty of life there, that, you know, it's difficult to have children under, you know, difficult economic conditions, right?
I have a question, and it's not well thought out, but maybe it's somewhat related to what Yoy was asking, or a variation on that, because I wrote down pretty early in your talk a quotation that kind of stuck out, and that is Russia as a nation capable of producing such mothers.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking of, you know, cases that we hear about of abuse or infanticide in the United States when mm-hmm. a mother kills a child, and the reaction, you know, the knee-jerk reaction might be, how could that mother do mm-hmm. that? Sort of, mm-hmm. how could that individual mm-hmm. make this choice mm-hmm. to do this mm-hmm. as an individual? And mm-hmm. then maybe only in the background would we say, what are the social conditions mm-hmm. that create that, versus what I was hearing from your talk in Russia, like, what are we as a nation that we've created such mm-hmm. a world? So I don't know where to go from here other than the very superficial, like, American individualism versus mm-hmm. Russian collectivism. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you could help me tease that out a little bit more.
Well, I think part of this really deep-rooted national anxiety that I was reading being expressed in some of those accounts that I excerpted really is based on this really tenacious myth of motherhood that is so long-standing within Russian culture, right? That there is such a long-standing association of motherhood and Russianhood and the, sort of the Soviet legacy of, you know, this indomitable Russian worker mother who can kind of accomplish everything, right? That if you start reading accounts of individual women who challenge or somehow present a threat to this sort of really firmly entrenched mythology, that stimulates this kind of, you know, almost hysterical kind of rhetoric. I mean, that would be, I guess, my best explanation for that. I don't know.
We can talk
so, yeah, that's. I mean, it's a really interesting question. I feel like I have to kind of mull it over a bit to give you a more fully fleshed answer. But I think that would be my initial response, is that I think it has to do with this myth, right, and how well entrenched it's been for, you know, millennia.
Other questions?
I mean, it does seem that the idealization and demonization of women are, in a sense, two sides of the same coin.
Of course, yeah.
Women of a very
right.
different nature there, and
right.
precisely, I think the quote that Jennifer was given, it was, okay, you know, doesn't have enough money to feed the child. Well, yes, there are these economic issues, but then
right.
you can scapegoat people, you know, for it and say, well, it's all to do with
right.
personal reasons rather
right.
than what are the economic
right, right.
reasons for that. That seems to be.
Well, and I think also, you know, demographic crises
mm-hmm.
have historically been linked with, you know, nations' perceptions of themselves, right? That a demographic crisis is somehow signifies some sort of, you know, a chink in the national armor, right? I think the extent to which demographic pressure has fallen so exclusively on women is maybe a distinctive characteristic of the 20th century in the Soviet Union and Russia. I guess that would be maybe my other contribution to your question.
Mm-hmm. Other questions? Well, let's end the formal program now, but I hope you'll hang out for a few minutes in case people have individual questions for you. And please join me in thanking.
Thank you.